times. I keep flipping through the pages trying to find what in the hell he's talking about. Okay, I think we're up. The AGP video said that we're up and running and we're broadcasting and people are looking at us. So here we go. This is the Thursday, March 19th, 2009 Zone 3 Advisory Committee meeting. And we have Mr. Doug Bird sitting in for Dean Benedix, and who will at this point call the roll, and we can see who's here.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Ms. Dean?
Here.
Mr. Ehring?
Here.
Mr. Myers?
Here.
Mr. Costello? Mr. Gehring?
I'm here.
Mr. Wallace? Mr. Reynolds? Very good. We have a quorum.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Mr. Bird, we do have some people that have been confirmed by the Board of Supervisors. I'm thinking maybe you could go through who those are.
I'd be glad to. Yes, on the 17th of the month, which was just this week, this Tuesday, the Board of Supervisors approved Robert Myers to be appointed as the City of Grover Beach regular member and Debbie Peterson as the alternate member for Grover Beach and Mr. Ed Haig to be appointed as the City of Pismo Beach alternate member. So they are all ready to come and sit and be voting representatives.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, this is the time for a public comment. This is the time for members of the public who have anything they'd like to address the committee on that is not on the agenda. And if you could come up and tell us what you have on your mind, we can't act on it or do much about it other than perhaps put it on a future agenda if it's an item that we need to address. So anyone who has something like that to address the committee on, please step forward.
Nancy Castle, AGP Video. I just wanted to let you folks know, and the people who may be watching this, that we will be covering the special RAC meeting that's going to be held the first weekend in April. It's a Saturday meeting. I'm not really sure about the content, but since they're having us videotape it, I believe it's going to be important, and it'll give you the opportunity to see it if you can't make the meeting. Thank you.
Nancy, could you give us the date of that meeting?
It's April 4th, and it's a Saturday, April 4th, and it starts at 8 a.m. in the morning. They're expecting it to be 8 to noon. They are setting up for overflow, so they think that there's going to be quite a large attendance. So,
and it primarily deals with the Los Osos groundwater, stormwater situations.
Ah, so maybe it's not of great interest to you folks, but stormwater is an issue for everybody. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who'd like to come forward and speak on an item that's not on the agenda? Yep, seeing none. The minutes of November 20th, I hope everyone's had a chance to look at them. If you haven't, take a moment, look at them, and if they seem okay, we'll entertain a motion or any corrections.
I'll make a motion, Mr. Chairman, that we approve the minutes of November 20th.
I second that.
Any other comments on those minutes?
Well, I wasn't present. I doubt I could vote on that. So.
Then you can abstain, I suppose. Okay, thank you, Mr. Myers. Okay, well, all in favor and one abstention, aye.
Aye.
I don't see Mr. Mellon is in the audience. Thank you, Don. Do you have something you wish to talk to us about on the rec area?
Yes, I have a rec report. Mm-hmm. Apologize for not being able to get it into the agenda prior to the meeting.
The meeting's January 15th, just in November.
Okay. Oh, and January
15th. Yeah. Don Mellon, General Services, County Park staff. Our visitation in the last few winter months was substantially lower. As I've got listed here, we've seen about a 12% decline. We're probably seeing that from some adverse weather, the typical downturn that we're seeing in the economy. Probably people aren't traveling as much. Our aquatic nuisance species inspections continue. I'll be presenting right after this on some information about us modifying our protocol. We're still focusing on educating vessel owners and getting the message out about clean and dry. As far as critical incidents, in this last period, we've only had one. We had a heart attack with a successful resuscitation using an automatic external defibrillator. One of our campground hosts had a heart attack, and we were able to bring him back using the defibrillator. So that was a success story there. As far as fishing is concerned, overall, the trout fishing has been pretty good. Crappie and bluegill is actually been better this year than it was in the last few winters. Bass, catfish are slow. And I'm sure whether you know or not, but the Fish and Game sponsored plants have been suspended pending some illegal action against Fish and Game regarding trout plants. We are no longer, County Parks is no longer planting trout, at least not this year, due to some budget constraints. However, the Friends of Lopez Lake is going to be sponsoring two plants, one on March 31st and another on April 28th. Our interpretive events have continued as scheduled. Right now, we're working on infrastructure repairs, taking care of the park, the picnic sites and picnic tables, fire rings, trying to take care of the worst stuff first and just bring things back into alignment. And the second phase of the Department of Boating and Waterways launch facility improvement project hopefully will be completed before summer, where we'll have the docks that are being constructed will actually be in place. And with that, I've got the revenue for February and the attendance for February listed here. Is there any questions that you would have?
Any questions for Mr. Miller?
I don't have any.
No, I'm fine. No, thank you.
Mr. Myers? Well, Don, it looks like the revenue's down some. Is there something, is there a thought as to why that is?
We're not seeing as many passes being sold. I think overall with tourism in the county is suffering due to the downturn in the economy. I think we're going to see some rebounding here soon with the gas prices going down. We're looking really strong for summer. Kind of in a nutshell, our reservations for summer are looking really strong. So we're looking at kind of coming back and rebounding out of this. If it's going to hit and we're going to have lower visitation, I'd rather have it happen during the winter than during the summer, because that's when we make the bulk of our revenue anyways, during the summer.
All right. Thank you. Did that raise any other questions on the part of the committee? No? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Mellon. Now, before we go on to the next item, Mrs. Dean has called to my attention that I didn't mention the January 15th, 2009 minutes. And Mr. Ring, did you intend to approve those minutes also, or would you want to?
I'm sorry, I didn't see that they were there. I would make a motion that we approve them.
Okay, thank you.
I would second that.
Okay, motion second. And
I'd have to abstain since I wasn't officially a member, so.
All right. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Oh, now the Quagga Mussel Boat Inspection Update. And I think you're on again.
I'm still here. if you could direct your attention up to the screen here. This is a aquatic nuisance species, a Quagga Protocol Adjustment. It's some adjustments that were made in the original protocols that we were using prior to February of this year. Let me move in here. Our original protocol, what we were doing at that point was a boat would arrive at the park entrance, come in. The boat would be checked for a clear tag, and what we're doing right now is we're tagging boats that are coming out of the reservoir after they have been inspected and after they had been decontaminated, and we would put a wire tag from the boat hook on the bow to the trailer, so we would know if that boat had actually been taken off of that trailer. When they come back into the park, we know that it hasn't been in another reservoir. Let me go back here. I'm going too fast. If the tag is valid, a launch permit is given with the date and CF numbers, and the operator proceeds for launch. Untagged boats they do a quick operator interview, the location and date of last launch. We're looking for launches on infected waters, because if they had been on infected waters, they're placed on a 30-day list, and they're rejected on the spot if they've been in. And we've got a list from Fish and Game of infected waters. Almost all of them are in San Diego County, but that doesn't include the Colorado River and several water bodies out of state. That watch list is kept on a server with access to both Santa Margarita and Lopez Lake, and the list gets updated daily. and vessels aren't permitted to launch until 30 days from the date of the attempted launch at the park. So in other words, if you come in and you tell us that you've been on a reservoir that's been infected, then you cannot come back to a county park for 30 days. Untagged boats get inspected. They're asked about live bait, crawdads, minnows. That's a real serious thing that you need to look for, because then you know if they're coming in, then you've got water coming in from another reservoir. then we would decontaminate the boat with a pressure washer at 140 degrees. We'd then issue them a launch permit with CF numbers and dates, so we know when they had been in. Then the operator's allowed to launch. The modified protocol, which is what we're doing now, we've been doing since February, the same tagging and clear tag process takes place, the same 30-day infected lake policy. What we're doing now is we call an enhanced address query, where we're spending more time trying to find out where the boat is actually coming from. We're doing practical, focused inspections, and we're continuing our educations at Education Information, and this will also go into detail on this. And we're monitoring where our bass clubs are coming from, because we know that there's been some concerns about tournament activity. So we kind of monitor what lakes they have been on and, you know, where they've been throughout the state. The enhanced address query, we're asking for the vessel registration. So by asking for the certificate of number, we're able to find out where the residence of that vessel is, or where it's actually coming from. We make sure that it's obviously currently registered, because that's the law, and we ask where it's from. And is it coming from a caution zone? Those caution zones are anywhere from Los Angeles County south. I've got a map here in a moment that I'll show you that has an imaginary line that we kind of use. If it's down in this caution zone, it also includes any area out of state or in a region that's determined to be near an infested area. And it's based on Fish and Game updates and their website that updates it consistently on a daily basis. Practical focused inspections. We're looking for things like signs of previous mooring. If you look in this picture here, you can really see that boat's been moored somewhere. And if a vessel were to come in that had been previously moored anywhere, you're going to see the signs of that boat being moored. You're going to see a scum line. You're going to see algae, even if it's dried. Any signs that a boat's been moored someplace else, and they would automatically be rejected. And that's something that Fish and Game has really focused on, is not so much the transient boats that are in and out of a lake in one day, but the boats that have been moored somewhere. In addition to that, we're doing things like, and this is all in addition to our regular protocols that we were doing. I didn't include those in here, but these are kind of things that we're really focusing on. Looking at feeling the trailer bunks. The bunks are these areas here. We're feeling underneath to see if they're dry or not, because if a boat's been sitting out of the water for any length of time, those bunks are going to be dry. You can almost run your fingers along them and dust comes off. I saw a boat the other day that had sow bugs living in between the bunk and the boat. So I know that the boat had been setting for quite a long period of time. Boat trailer lights for water, weeds, or algae. One of the things that our regional fisheries biologist was talking about was how a lot of times boats will come in with water inside the lights. And so we check the lights. We look for weeds on the trailer. We look for on the rear of the tow vehicle to see if anything's on there. So if the vessel is not coming from a caution zone and it goes through a focused inspection and it's clean and dry and drained, then launch is permitted. We go through the same tagging process. We give them a launch receipt and they're able to launch. There's the line I was talking about. Or if the vessel's not clean, dry, and drained, or if it has any of these factors involved, the water in the bilge, water in the live well, standing water in any compartment, foreign matter on the hull, aquatic weeds, mud on the trailer, anchor, rope, anything, or refusal to go through, or if they have an internal ballast system, they are rejected. So we're using the same criteria as before. We're just expanding our search and our inspection of the vessel. So this modified protocol, what it really does is it's more expedient, it's cost-effective, it's practical, it actually makes sense rather than to go out and decontaminate every boat that comes through. And more than anything, it's sustainable. With the staffing issues that we have and the recent budget cuts, there's no way that I could maintain a program there that's going to wash and inspect every boat that comes through. Now, again, we are monitoring the activity of the boats that come in because every boat that comes in has to come through the front gate. So the vessels that are tagged, we know that they haven't come off the trailer. The vessels that aren't tagged are all going to get inspected, but only the ones coming from a caution zone are going to get decontaminated. And we're focusing on that inspection instead of the decontamination. We feel that our rangers are doing a good enough job. They've been educated enough and had enough training that they have the ability to do that. Our tagging system remains very successful. 75% of the launches that we have are returning clear tags, which shows that there is some loyalty or some localness about this. And primarily it's people that are coming from this county that are, and we have a reciprocal system going between us and Santa Margarita Lake currently. And we're working with Kachuma. Right now we're taking their tags because they have a very similar protocol that we do. And we're going to have reciprocity with that reservoir as well. Our internal ballast decontamination that we do, which is, I'm not sure if you know what internal ballasts are, but on wakeboard boats, they actually have internal ballast systems where they take on water to lower the boat into the water so they throw up a bigger wake. And we're probably the first lake in California that instituted a internal ballast decontamination system. Rather than turning them away, we actually have, if you're able to get into the closed system and introduce chlorine into the system, we have the ability to work with them to decontaminate that boat. But if we cannot do that, we don't allow the boat on the lake. We started initially just not allowing those boats on the lake at all because of the fear. To me, I'm much more concerned about someone bringing 60 gallons of water in the lake than I am and there being a random quagga mussel on the hull, because that's just not going to happen unless the boat's been moored. And again, that exceeds the actual the fish and game standards for internal ballast. Overall, we're viewed as having one of the more successful and efficient inspection and decontamination programs in the region. this protocol that I'm discussing now was presented to the county and city public works staff on February 3rd, and no concerns were noted at that presentation. This protocol we have has been endorsed by the Department of Fish and Game and actually was developed between myself and Mark Watson, who is the regional fisheries biologist with his oversight. We actually began working with him on establishing these changes and worked with him every step of the way. And he actually was able to attend the meeting that we had on February 3rd. And right after February 3rd is when we went into doing this protocol. And this here, I apologize for not being able to shrink that down, but it just shows a flow chart that we use. They come in with a clear tag. If they don't, probably changes for us because they're no longer in a caution zone. Now we're all in a caution zone. So hopefully we'll see some action on the part of Monterey County at some point. So I would ask at this point if you have any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Mellon?
I'd like to ask one educational question for myself, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I presume a real concern about the mussels is when they're in the larva stage.
Correct.
We're worried about water and water carrying the larva. Then they grow up and they become little critters. So you're trying to keep the wetness from getting into that may contain larva into our lakes.
Absolutely. And that's where when we do that, the same original protocol that we have is inspect. They need to come in with their plug out of their boat. And their bilge needs to be completely empty, and they can't have any water in their bait tanks or their live wells.
Okay, good.
And, really any water in the vessel at all. We're not so concerned about ice chests that have ice and beer in them. You know, we're looking for things like a bucket with crawdads in it.
Yes,
that sort of thing.
I think your own target, yes.
Yeah. And at this point, my understanding is from Fish and Game and from the research that I've done is the mortality rate on the larvae, on the villagers, is really, really high. You need to have – and that, I think, is real indicative when you look at the path of how quagga mussels have traveled. And they came through the Colorado River aqueduct system and then infected all those lakes in San Diego County. And that was over a year ago, and we don't have any infection north since then, other than a few lakes there. All of them are metropolitan water district lakes, and all of them are connected to the Colorado River aqueduct. So that kind of shows you that in a year that unless someone's traveling with a boat with live quagga mussels attached or unless they're taking thousands of gallons of water to another reservoir, the odds are that we may not see it. I'm hoping that's the case. We definitely know that when you have a conveyance system of, thousands of acre feet of water like the Colorado Aqueduct, Colorado River Aqueduct, now that obviously moves them. So while we're still concerned about those small amounts of water, the less water, and I'm not so concerned about a drop of water as I am looking in those internal ballasts and making sure that they're not bringing tons of water in with them.
What's the mortality rate once they get out of the water? How long do they take them to dry out? Any idea on
that? You know, as far as the veligers, they die almost instantly when they need water to live in. But the mussels themselves can live in wet conditions, can live as long as 30 days.
Okay, but the little swimmers, are there.
They have to have water.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Now I know more than I did when I came here.
Ted, Mr. Erie, anything?
No, I'm fine. My boat's got a tag on it. Pick it up to Lopez all the time. No, any problems.
Yeah, Ms. Dean?
You mentioned the two lakes to the north still have no policy or no protocol for that. What is the prognosis with working with Monterey County?
Well, I've been following as much as I can what's going on. I've met with John Hollenbeck, and he's very concerned with the Nacimiento Water Project. And you know, I haven't had an update lately. I know that that Mark Watson, from the biologist with Fish and Game that I've been meeting with, has met with Tom Shepard and the Water Resources Agency guy, Bill Phillips, is it, in Monterey County, have recently met, and they are concerned about.
Question. Do we have anything where we're looking at any used pumps or things like that that come into the county on a daily basis and then are installed someplace? Or do we have any kind of a program to look at that sort of thing?
And
i.e., supposing you got a used valve or pump or piece of pipe or something like that from San Diego and brought it up here and installed it someplace.
A used pump and then put it like...
Well, used pipe or valve or something.
And then used it near the reservoir, in the reservoir?
Yeah, and used it near the reservoir.
Yeah, I think a real concern would be stormwater.
Any of our water or anything like that.
I think it could be a concern. I think that once it gets into biofilter, once it gets into grass, again, the villagers can't live without water at all. So it would be a concern of mine if somebody was right next to a creek and was rinsing out a pump that they had or something. But I don't know. That likelihood doesn't seem high. It's an interesting concept to think of that. But, you definitely have to think of the stormwater concept that what you're talking about is runoff. And that was a concern of ours immediately is if we're decontaminating boats, that's why we decontaminate them into the sanitary sewer, because we don't want to – it wouldn't make any sense to spray the mussels off of a boat into a lake. And consequently, we have not found a single quagga mussel anywhere. Contrary to at one point, I know we had the media reporting about a year ago that rangers were busy spraying quagga mussels off of boats over the weekend. It made it sound like we were walking through the parking lot and crushing the shells as we walked across. So that was just a little bit of misinformation. But with the monitoring activities that are going on with Public Works, there's been no activity noted at all. So, and they're pretty. Pretty consistent about it, monitoring twice a month on both reservoirs, and they're apparently doing Nacimiento and San Antonio as well.
So we have not found a single mussel on a boat as yet.
No. But at this point, we're just going to continue doing what we're doing. We feel like we've streamlined the process and modified it down to the point where we're really doing some good, rather than to be out just going through motions. We're really focusing on what could really bring them in. Rather than, you think about it, there was talk about, looking for mussels on a hull. We still look for mussels on a hull, but a hull is dry. By the time it makes it to your reservoir, it's been air dried. We're still checking all the nooks and crannies and everywhere they could be, but to decontaminate a hull after it's traveled, 40 or 50 miles in the wind just is not really practical, and it's not part of a practical program at all, and we've heard that from Fish and Game as well.
We have some evidence that chlorine is a good, successful decontaminant.
That's what I've heard. I've attended a seminar or a webcast through Public Works, and that was one of the things that they discussed. And I don't remember what reservoir was doing it, but they were actually using a closed portion of the system, and were relying on and that also provided the contact time for water quality further down the road. I'm not enough of a water guy to know that, but they are using that. I've heard There's someone else. John, do you have information on that?
Yeah, this is John Beaton.
Yeah, potassium chloride I've heard as well. Check to see what kind of THMs are formed. We're looking to see how quickly those THMs would, if you will, evaporate into the atmosphere or degrade. Our terminal has roughly a 30-day holding time, so that would give us a little bit of time there for those THM levels to possibly reduce. So it's one of the things we're looking at. If chlorine can be used successfully, you know, that would be great. That would certainly be one of the easier chemicals to use, but we do have to be concerned with those disinfection byproducts. For a reservoir like Santa Margarita, that water there is used by the city of San Luis Obispo. Their particular treatment plant does not respond well to having pre-oxidants in the water. They use ozone there. It's a big concern for them. So what might work for Lopez may not work for something like Santa Margarita. So it's I believe Dennis Delzite is working right now to come up with the sort of a mussel response plan. So if the worst case happens, if we do find these mussels in our reservoirs, what can be done to cope with those and hopefully eliminate them? So,
but in terms of using it in a boat ballast, so it would be effective?
I believe so, yes. Given enough time, you know, the mussels, if they're in the ballast there, if you've got some of those little small mussels that are just forming, you know, they'll close up when they feel something that is a threat to them, but they can't stay closed forever. They've got to open up. They've got to breathe again. They've got to live. So given enough contact time, that could be effective. When they're very small, especially as the villagers, you know, they don't have that hard shell around them yet to provide that protection. So you know, I think it's a good idea to add the chlorine to those ballast tanks. And
I just have a comment. I'm very, very pleased to hear that we're doing something to anticipate if we do get mussels in our lake, how do we avoid spreading them around the whole world? So
absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yes, yes. As Don mentioned, this Nacimiento pipeline, you know, it's a yes. big project up
yes.
there, and Nacimiento is a very high-risk, you know, lake. You know, if we get mussels in that pipeline, you know, that could be devastating to
yes.
Those North County residents. So we are very interested. It's much easier to keep them out than it is to
get
rid of them.
I
really applaud the work that Parks has done to really take the lead on that. You know, the fish and game biologists have said, you know, we are one of the best in the state, you know, for what we're doing here. We recognize our lakes are at very high risk. The quality of the water there is just ideal for these mussels. They would love to be in there. But luckily, we're separated from the State Water Project. We're remote from these you know, San Diego. It takes time for those boats to get up here. So those things are working in our favor.
Good.
And Mr. Del Rio, did you have something?
Ernie Del Rio, Park Superintendent. I just wanted to expand on something that Don was talking about. I heard him mention the monitoring program at some of the other lake facilities. I just wanted to give you assurances that at Nacimiento Lake, San Antonio Lake, Cochuma Lake, and our two lake facilities, we do have monitoring stations at strategic locations throughout the reservoirs, and that is recorded and tracked by Public Works, San Luis Obispo County Public Works, and that information is disseminated to all of those agencies. So if there ever is one of these little mussels discovered, we're going to know about it right away.
We're not included in your packet, but we do have them today.
Okay, thank you. Greg?
Yeah, I was asked by Dean Benedict to come and give the operations report and also discuss five other items. I'm not sure how familiar you are with them, so ask questions as you will. For today, 319.09 is when I generated all these numbers. For lake elevation, it's 497.92. Acre feet is 29,892. Capacity of 60.7%. Rainfall to date, 11.98 inches. Plant production is currently 3.75 MGD. Filter turbidity range off the membrane racks are 0.01 to 0.015. Terminal visibility is 14 feet. Downstream release is 3.5 MGD. And state water is 0.85 MGD. Currently in the plant, We have a disinfectant called chlorine dioxide. Do you want me to give an update or a status of that? And we're currently in use.
Up and running?
Yes, it is up and running. I just got a email last week from IDI, International Dioxide, because we're working on a bulk storage tank for that chemical to give us a more consistent concentration to feed into the water. So I have a date set with them, April 1st, to discuss that proposal. In the plant, I'm also making some modifications to where we add the primary disinfectant chlorine into the post-disinfection to help keep a more stable disinfection entering into the distribution system. So I started that on February 10th, and I pulled some THM numbers. They were no greater than 30, 35 leaving the plant. So it looks like a good application point at this time.
And that's with the chlorine dioxide running?
That's with chlorine dioxide running, yes. State water feed to site chemical feed makeup water, with the amount of hardness in our water, for the membranes, you have to do a chemical cleaning on them every other day and then once a month. And with those chemical cleanings, with the hardness of our water, as you add this chemical in it, it kind of chews up the residuals, if you would, so there's not enough chemical to clean the racks. So we're dumping the tanks after a 3-wash period, where we should be getting like a 5-wash period, according to the Paul's proposal. So that is in and running. I'm in the process of collecting data still, but it looks a little bit better during the wintertime. I still need to go through the summertime to see what happens. Upon occasion, the plant will shut down based on CT ratios for Giardia virus, power failure, or turbidity, the cloudiness of the water. And when the plant shuts down, it's an automatic mode. The computer system will just shut it.
I'll come out someday.
Mr. Myers was suggesting we put together a list of acronyms, and maybe between you and Ron and Doug and Dean, we could get that.
Sure. Not a problem.
Any questions? Anyone from the audience have a question or issue on this item?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kessler. And I noticed John Beaton's name is on there. Are you going to come up and talk to us, John?
John Beaton, water quality manager with the Public Works Department. I think Craig's covered all of the operations report. I can start in on the plant upgrade under old business, if you like.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. I have four items I'll bring to your attention. First is the Paul performance test. That's been completed. You may recall the upgraded plant uses membrane filters, which is a new technology for us. Those membranes are provided by Paul Corporation. When we solicited bids for membranes, we were interested more in more than just the cost of the membranes themselves. We wanted to see what the life cycle cost of those of operating those membranes over the years, including electricity and chemical usage, to see what the total cost for the package would be. So we asked the vendors to bid on that. Paul Corporation did. This performance test that they just completed was a demonstration, was a requirement that they demonstrate that they could actually achieve those specifications that they originally bid. It was a 40-day test. They've given us a report. Currently, that report, we've looked at it ourselves, but we've also sent it to Black & Veatch, the designers of the plant. They are to go through that report, make sure that everything is correct on there, that the assumptions or the statements that Paul Corporation has made are accurate. I'm sure we'll come back with a report on that after Black & Veatch reports to us. And that should be possibly as soon as this week. Another item is the control strategy. This is a much more complex plant than the old one. To make it work or to run it effectively, Craig Kessler and the other operators there utilize a SCADA system, a supervisory control and data acquisition system, a set of computers to run the multitude of valves and pumps and chemical feed solutions there. It takes data in, constantly monitors flow rates, chemical residuals, quality of the water that's being produced. It's a very complex system. And it's all controlled by computers and a big computer program. What we've asked Black and Veatch to do, these are the people who actually wrote this program for us, is to come back with a narrative that describes how that program works. You know, how are they actually controlling the plant? What flows do they look at? How does that determine what chemical feed rates are needed? And I think it's important to have that and do work inside of that DAF unit without it being we'll call it confined space, and you need the harness. And it was impossible, you know, to work. So Black and Veatch has had to remove that cover, and we now have a building around it, so you can literally walk in through a door, and it's much more accessible. Provides the same protection to the to the DAF unit, but it's just much more accessible. It's easier to maintain. It's the way it should have been done in the first place. So we're happy to see that. We've also extended that DAF building, a canopy from that DAF building, to cover our chlorine dioxide contact chamber. If you recall, when they Black and Veatch first specified for this chlorine dioxide contact chamber, it was an open chamber. It was open to the atmosphere, open to the sunlight. Craig Kessler and others had great concerns about that because chlorine dioxide is sensitive to sunlight. It can be degraded by ultraviolet light. It can off-gas. And, in fact, when the plant started up, it wasn't working as well as it needed to. And they came in and provided some floating covers over that, and that improved it substantially and made it a viable component for the plant. What we've done now is extended a metal canopy over the whole chlorine dioxide contact chamber to provide a little more protection. So that's should be done this week. Might even be done today, but that looks good. Last item are the stainless steel headers for the Paul membranes. If you recall, one of the things that we noticed during that first year of operation were small pinhole leaks that were starting in that stainless steel header. And Paul Corporation looked at that and said, you know, they've seen that before. It's what they called microbial-induced corrosion, MIC, M-I-C, another acronym. But
surprised my microbes could do that.
It's pretty interesting. They've got all these different bacteria and fungi and such, and you can get a little bit on the pipe there, and they'll form a little layer over the top, and as they go about their living, they secrete acids and things in it, and it can actually chew up or dissolve stainless steel and any other kind of piping. So Paul Corporation has seen this in some other places. As a result, they now use high-density polyethylene for the piping, and that's more resilient, less susceptible to this corrosion. And so they are going to come in and replace all the stainless steel piping of the header racks there with this HDPE. We had some concerns about some of the other piping there, and we asked them to look at that to see if it needed to be replaced as well. It hasn't needed to be replaced in their other plants, but they are looking at it, and we'll discuss with them the results if we've seen any of this microbial-induced corrosion and the other piping, if they need to replace that as well. But right now it doesn't look like that's necessary. Mr. Kessler talked about recycling some of the this water, filtering to waste. It's another place where we're looking to replace some of the valving or modify some of the valving to facilitate some of the filtering to waste to allow us to operate the plant more efficiently. Now we have two active, if we call them sludge beds, there that the plant is using. It really doesn't provide enough capacity for the plant. The new plant does produce a fair amount of sludge. Comes off the staff units. The membranes are very effective at filtering all these wastes out of the water. We send those down to those sludge beds, allow the water in there to drain out of that sludge. We discharge that water into Arroyo Grande Creek, and then we dispose of the sludge to a landfill. With two sludge beds, we can't kind of keep ahead of it. So there is a project underway to see what can be done. I think we've been working with Kennedy Jenks to come in and evaluate that situation and possibly build two more sludge beds. Again, that would be a future capital improvement project that would be high on the list right now of things that need to be done. They may come back with some other recommendation to us, maybe a different kind of sludge bed, a different kind of filtering process down there. But when the original plant was built back in the late 60s, I think they envisioned having four sludge beds down there, and there's actually a place down there for four. In fact, the other two sludge beds were, if you will, partially developed. They had pits there for those sludge beds, but there was no underdrain system in it like the active sludge beds. The piping didn't go down there to there was no way for us to get the sludge to those beds and to use those. So developing those two other beds might be the most cost-effective solution right now. And
was it thought by what Black and Veatch at the time that we would be having to deal with considerably more of this sludge with those filters?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. It's again, we've been operating there for what, a year and a half now, there, and we've gotten by. You know, it has worked, but what we find is that one bed fills up. We start using the second one. That first bed is not quite dry yet before we would really like to switch. You know, so I think we can get by, but it's, you know, if we had more rain, you know, it would obviously take longer for these things to dry out. So I think with having, you know, three beds, more likely four beds there, would allow us to rotate through those beds more rapidly and improve the operations at the plant.
In your opinion now, since we've been operating this for about a year,
yes.
Is the plant performing the way it was anticipated in the design phase?
In the sense that we were meeting all these turbidity requirements, and we were able to produce the amounts of water that are needed, the quality of the water is, I think, meets those original standards. In that sense, I say yes, it has worked the way they anticipated. Problems that we've run into are scaling issues and that additional scaling that we did not have in the old plant. And again, personally, I think that may be related to one of the things that we're looking at to try to address that is as a lowering of that pH. And different ways of doing that, we can add certain acids to the raw water at the front of the plant, or we can use something like carbon dioxide, which is used effectively at a lot of other plants for pH adjustment. In fact, the old original Lopez plant, when they designed that, they had thought about, or they actually provided some provision for softening in that original plant, and where they would raise the pH of the water at the front end, cause all that hardness to settle out, and then lower the pH again with carbon dioxide. Over the years, they never implemented that at the plant. They just ran it the way that we've seen. We just lived with the hardness and didn't have to pay for that, the cost of that softening. The big concern with softening has to do with disposing of the sludge. It produces substantially more sludge even than this existing plant. When you start removing all that calcium and magnesium hardness, it's a real sludge producer. So,
I guess my last question is this was supposed to be automatic valves, it was supposed to be computer run, it was supposed to be easier to operate. Have you found yet
that it's less costly to operate or on schedule, or is it costing us more to operate the plant than we anticipated, or what? I mean, could you comment on that, please?
You know, it's I certainly can remember one of the very earliest meetings we had with Black and Veatch, and some of the Zone 3 members were there looking at all the different options for upgrading this plant. And it ranged from doing nothing to building a plant like what we have. And this was the high end. This was the most expensive option for us. But I remember a gentleman from Black and Veatch saying, well, if it was his money to spend, this is what he would do. And you'd end up with a plant where the operator could sit back in his chair, put his feet up on the desk, you know, and it'd run itself. And obviously, that is not the case. You know, that hasn't been our experience. It's been very labor intensive, but it's all new technology. It's a completely different way of treating the water. It's taken the operator some time to kind of get accustomed to that. Some of the nuances of our water here are unique to this area. And something I think even companies like Black and Veatch or Kennedy Jenks or Brown and Caldwell or any of these other engineering firms had not really experienced in the past. So I think we're getting there. I think we'll get to the point where it'll be second nature for us to operate this plant. You know, we've been able to reduce the number of hours that the operators need to staff the plant. We've been able to make improvements. Mr. Kessler has made some excellent recommendations for making some minor modifications to it that really improve the process there. And I think we'll continue with that for the next couple of years. And I certainly myself can foresee a time when it will operate a lot easier. It's never going to be something where, you know, all the operators sit there and put their feet up on the desk. But I think it'll continue to do the job that we want it to do and should last for a number of years. It's not a state of the art.
Going to, and you do have problems with automatic valves, especially electronic ones and this kind of thing. So I'm quite aware of that. Thank you, John.
Mrs. Dean, any questions?
Yeah, I have questions about sludge pits.
Yes.
And it sounds like if we implement the water softening system, we will need sludge pits.
When I mentioned water softening, I would be talking about softening the whole plant, which is not anything that we were prepared to do.
We were talking about that the last time.
You know, what we are doing is using softer water to make up those chemical cleaning solutions. And we talked about using a water softener for that small amount of water that we use to make up those solutions. It's not a small amount to you and me, 15,000 gallons or something. But relative to the 6 million gallons that, we could be producing a day, it's a pretty insignificant amount. So we looked at ways of softening that water, either through reverse osmosis or through an ion exchange softener. One of the ideas was we have state water available to us. The state water typically is, due to its source, a softer water. Why don't we just run that one instead of just running it straight into the pipeline, run it through the plant and then into the pipeline? And that's what we've done. That has, I think, made a difference. It's going to take a little bit of time to see how big a difference it's made. I have to believe that using that softer water to make up those cleaning solutions allows the cleaning solutions to work better, to last longer, do a better job on the membrane, allow us to clean the membranes less often because it's doing a better job, which will save us money down the road, energy costs and chemical costs, and really not cost us anything more. It's water that we were taking anyway. So I think that was a good move.
How much would it? Do you know how much a sludge pit would cost to implement or install a new one?
You know, I wouldn't be the best person to estimate that, but
probably unfair until you get the Kennedy Jenks.
We could look at that, and you know, someone like Mr. Gehring probably has a better idea of what it would cost to put in the French under drain and maybe improve the tops, but basically, you know, it's just It's just a pit in the ground that that we put a drain collection system underneath it and plumb it so that it can, you know, go to discharge to the areas that we want to discharge and receive influent from the areas that we want to receive influent. So it's some piping and some
it's simple and it's old fashioned.
You know, but that's but it. You put some sand layers and such in there, and there's some maintenance that has to be done over the years. But it's a pretty simple operation. It's just basically a sand filter that's down there. So
that shouldn't be too costly, should it?
Well, we have seen some preliminary estimates that I think are quite high. But at present, I think we need to hear from Kennedy Jenks on a more accurate cost for that feature. Yes.
Did that satisfy you, Mrs. Dean? Or
yeah.
More? Okay. Mr. Myers?
Just a comment. I just thank John for being forward-thinking and getting a text printout from our computer supplier about how that works on a quantitative basis. Someday that may really be important.
Yes.
Mr. Beaton, can you—
designed it that way in the first place. I think the design of that cover is one that Black & Veatch needs to cover the cost for it.
Yeah. Mr. Byrd, do you have any more on that? Do you know any more about that?
No, sir, I don't. I don't know if our accounting staff who's here tonight does or not.
Mr. Clemens, maybe you have an answer.
Will Clemens, Department Administrator for Public Works, and oversee the budget and accounting for the department. I don't know the particulars. I have not seen an item in the budget or for that, so I'm assuming that Black & Veatch is covering that cost for the redesign because no one's asked me for any money for that, so if that helps.
Yeah, that's possibly helpful. Okay. Thank you. And I notice that you're up, Mr. Clemens, next. Although before we start with you, let me ask the audience if you have anybody in the audience have anything on the presentation made by Mr. Beaton. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, no more questions or comments from the committee? No. Okay. All right. Well, then, Mr. Will Clemens, I think you're up.
Thank you, Will Clemens, again with Public Works Department. And tonight we're here to discuss the proposed 2009-2010 Flood Control Zone 3 budget. And we just have a brief PowerPoint presentation where I really am going to highlight the process that we go through in coming up with this budget. And then we're going to have a question and answer if you'd like to ask any specific questions on the budget. There are some extra copies of the budget for anyone that desires. And maybe we can address the question Mr. Ehring had earlier on the cost of the plant. I don't think it was ever envisioned that the new plant would cost less than the old one, but certainly what we found is it's costing a little more than we expected. And so we'll address how we're going to try to approach that issue going forward. So first I'll go through the budget review process. So typically we receive requests from our operators beginning of January for the coming year's budget. And then we have a very short turnaround time where we try to develop this document by the third Thursday in January and hand it to you at that meeting. We've always been successful in doing that, except this year it was not ready, so we had to mail it to you in January instead. So then the month of February, we spend discussing the budget with your finance individuals at your agencies. We go over the budget with them. We discuss the budget at the TAC, and then we come back to you tonight, hopefully for your endorsement of the budget, which we would then take to the board. And what we began to do was provide five-year estimates to your agencies. We began that in 2002 so that you could plan in advance for no doubt the impact this new plant would have on your water funds and the rates that you would need. So we have the blue line goes out again five years into the future. So we provided the last five-year estimate we provided to your agencies was last May, I believe. And so when we were developing the budget this year, we noticed that O&M costs continue to be higher than expected, higher than budgeted. And that is basically for two reasons. It's costing us more in labor. When the plan originally started, it was operated 24 hours a day. We were able to reduce that to 16-hour shifts. Then I think we're currently at 12 hours, speaking with our chief plan operator, and they hope to even go to reduce shifts, maybe down to 10 hours. So labor has cost more than expected, as well as chemical costs. So as Doug's going to mention later on in the agenda, we're proposing that an ad hoc committee be formed to do an operations audit to involve your agencies, some members from your advisory committee, perhaps some members from the TAC, and any of your finance people that would like to be involved, as well as our operators, so that we can, with a multitude of counselors, there is wisdom. So hopefully we can look at the operations and find areas where we can gain some efficiencies so that hopefully we can reduce costs. Whether or not we're able to, I don't know. But that's hopefully what this operational audit will tell us. So that's the budget to actual comparison over the years. Next slide, please. I can't really read these numbers, but in your budget, this summarizes the billings to your agencies for next year. And there's also a detailed line-by-line budget, which you would find on page 5. Page 5 of the budget is a line item detail of the budget for next year. So we can discuss any of those details if you'd like. Next slide, please. So this is an overall summary of what's happening. Our O&M costs continue to be higher than expected. So those are increased in the budget by 17%. Hopefully that operational audit will help us to come up with ways to reduce that O&M budget if possible. One thing that was fortuitous this year was the fact that we continue to put off the completion of the water treatment plant upgrade. Means that we've basically told them that we're going to live within that five-year estimate that we prepared last May. One of the challenges is, since operating costs are going up, we're going to have to find, if we can't reduce those, find other areas to reduce in the future years. And that would typically be your capital outlay items. We'd have to defer some capital outlay in order to stay within that total budget that we've agreed to. I must interject here that the billing for 09-10 is still below what we said it would be. So it's not as if we're coming back for more money than was expected a year ago. But we are within that budget, and basically because we don't have that debt service to pay. So looking into the future for the next 5 years, what we could have done was proposed a budget that was significantly under what we told you last year. However, realizing the challenge we have with the operations, we're doing something, we're proposing something that we haven't done before, which is in the policies that we have for reserves, and that is to fund a capital reserve by agency. so that we would put it in the bank so that we could use that money in the next 5 years to offset those capital costs that will be coming. The other option is not to set up that reserve and simply bill the agencies less this year. But then that would mean we wouldn't have that reserve to go to if those capital items became priorities, if we weren't able to defer them. So that's new for this year, and it's something we've discussed with the finance and the TAC, and we asked them to relay to you any of their concerns or comments on that, on the funding of that reserve. It's something that we can do by agency, so it's not an all or nothing deal. If one agency doesn't want to do it, you can make that as part of your motion, and we won't fund it for that agency. So there's a lot of flexibility here, but that's our proposal. And that's why the capital outlay you see is so high, is we're trying to front load the money, the billings we charge to you to cover that 1 year reprieve we have in debt service. Next slide, please. And that is the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any specific questions you may have on the approach or specific items.
Mr. Herring, it looks like you're up.
Thank you. Well, one of the things I have to object to, because this is the first time that I've seen this budget, okay? It was not mailed to me. And tonight's the first time I had an opportunity to look at that. Our representative on the TAC told me that it was going to get the investment interest on it on short-term finance, but I'd rather it accrue to the city of Pismo Beach than to the county of San Luis. So now I don't have time to take this back to my council. It has to be a council decision, of course, but that would just be off the top of my head. With that, I can't digest all these numbers in this short period of time right now, and then be prepared to vote on this. So I would probably have to suggest that we either have a interim meeting between now and then for the passage of this in order to. But I would suggest that to you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And Mrs. Dean, you're of the same mind, it sounds like?
Yes, I am. This is the first I've seen the budget. I know our TAC representative did see it, and so I was forewarned. And the city of Aurora Grande is not the only one going through a rate study. We're actually in Oceano going through a water master plan and a sewer master plan and rate studies for all of those. And because of what's going on in the whole country right now, everybody's feeling the hurt. And I would like to put off this additional cost to our ratepayers as long as we can, just to see if something improves in the economy. So, again, I think we need to digest this, take it back to our board. And I would like to keep it as low as possible for our ratepayers. We have people that can't afford their water bills. We have tried to keep up with everything, with the Lopez water treatment plant costs and the seismic retrofit of the dam, and we have a big fee on our bi-monthly bills that go toward that. It's actually a whole bunch more than my water costs in many cases. So if we can not do some of these capital improvements and look at it again next year and give us a good idea of what we're in for with the payments being made next year, so that can be included in our rate study so that people are prepared. We may have to do adjustments in 5% increments. I'm not sure. So there's a lot to consider here. And it's scary. It's scary for our ratepayers. And that's it.
Okay, thank you for that. And Mr. Myers, did you have anything you'd like to add?
I have a couple of questions, basically. The five-year budget proposal that we reached 2008, and then from that point on, the blue line goes off by itself, obviously, because we haven't gotten there yet for the experience. Is that accelerating or increasing blue line, is that due primarily to capital improvements as opposed to operational maintenance costs?
Primarily, yes.
I thought from what you were saying, because we're getting our hours down, and we got, and that's balancing the other costs somewhat, I guess. But what is
billings by about $1 million a year? The water treatment plant, once we start paying principal and interest, will have the effect of increasing billings by, I want to say, about $1.8 million annually. So those are the two major reasons for the increased billings over the past several years.
And if we didn't go for the reserve, how would that blue line look, basically? Would it come down significantly? Or?
Yes. So the reserve amount was proposed at $340,000 for 9-10. So if we did not bill the agencies for that, that blue line would drop by $340,000. If you had specific capital projects that you didn't want to move forward on, could go down further.
All right. I'm having sort of the same problem my colleagues are about voting on this tonight, because I wasn't told, didn't understand maybe voting on something quite this significant. So I would probably need to get some staff input. I wasn't given staff input before I came here, and I don't know our cost structure on this stuff here. So I guess I would suggest we are to defer for a day or two or a week maybe if we can.
You know, technically, we have our board will adopt this budget in June. So I think your next meeting is May. Is that true?
Yes. Right.
So theoretically, we could come back.
But let me suggest that perhaps we have time between now and about this time next month to get the ad hoc committee together and perhaps the TAC together, along with the finance directors from those communities that are concerned, and see if we can iron out these issues at a meeting within about a month, and then come back.
Yeah, I don't think the ad hoc. I envision, as Doug's going to mention a little bit more, that ad hoc committee probably won't have any conclusions for probably a year. So it's not going to be something that you can pull together and have a meeting and decide that we can reduce our O&M.
But we could certainly get the technical committee together with the finance directors
true.
And decide what we want to do with regard to these capital improvement
correct.
Plans.
So right? that's where you can really have discussion to affect the budget, because really we can't reduce the O&M budget below where it's at. That's what it's costing to run the plant. But we certainly can not bill for the capital reserve, and we cannot bill for certain capital projects if that's your desire. And these are certainly projects that can be discussed probably with the TAC and the finance director's input. However, as I said, the billings as they are in this budget are not more than was expected this year. So,
from our city council, we had a meeting on the 10th regarding water rates, and some of the council did have comments on the billings that we were going to be getting from the county regarding tonight's budget. Several of our council were concerned with the escalating costs of the water. As you saw, Mr. Clemens' graph there seems to be going up, and they were very concerned about that. The expectation, I think, is similar to what you expressed here this evening, is that if we have a new plant and, you know, we paid all of the funds for it, then we would expect that this thing would probably run by itself. And so there's, you know, that same expectation from our city council. The other concerns also were of the expenses of the ongoing operational expenses. We're encouraged and like to work with the county to identify, you know, whatever efficiency measures that we can. But I think that we really need to take a close look at that and see where the savings might be in that area. We've also asked the county, as you heard Mr. Clemens explain at our meeting with them, about looking into adjusting the budget so that we have a consistent funding for the capital outlays. Right now, I think the county just puts in projects each year, and the cost fluctuates. And what we'd like to see is a consistent amount of money in that particular line item, and then adjust the projects to the funding available. That may require delaying some of the projects 2 years or a year to have enough funding for them, but we think that that is a better way to address the rate structure. And so as we take that and put that into our rates, it's at a more consistent price or a cost, it's easier to manage the rates for our customers. So I think they're agreeable to doing that, as Mr. Clemens said. Those are some of the comments that they had. I know our member's not here this evening, but I did want to pass those along to you. Thank you.
Mr. Spagnuolo, before you leave the stand, could you comment on whether you think that process would work? Would going back to the technical committee and getting the finance directors involved, would that be helpful? Or is there another process you think would be more helpful?
Well, I think taking a look at it, again, with some representatives from each agency would be better. I don't know if we need all of those folks to get in a room and work on it, but I do think there needs to be some representative from each agency that can address the budget issues.
Yes, but you see, it's not just strictly a budget issue. I don't know for certain, but I suspect there are some capital projects that we're going to have to do fairly soon because of the maintenance that would result if we don't do them.
Oh, I certainly think
that's why I'm thinking that maybe the technical people would be helpful.
I think so. I mean, I think the list of projects that are have been identified in the back of this budget is substantial, and I think we were asking the county to sort of prioritize some of those, and I don't know that they have at this point.
The cost increases so that we can communicate that to our residents and customers as they to further enhance their understanding of the cost going on into the future.
Okay, thank you for that. Any questions of Mr. Chisholm before he sits down? No?
Well, what does the committee think about the idea of getting the TAC with the finance directors and seeing what can be worked out?
Well, I think that's a good suggestion. I like this ad hoc committee that they're talking about putting together. You know, we certainly need some technical expertise on it. Mm-hmm. And that should be drawn from the TAC, I think. And but do we need to get all the members from? It might be too unwieldy if we had them from each agency. So it might be a good idea to split that up.
It doesn't seem to me that getting tech involved is going to produce a whole lot between now and the next couple of months. We're not going to redesign this plant in a month or two, and so we need to get the budget process behind us, and it seems from what I heard tonight, the basic issue is, do we authorize this reserve for the next 5 years, or do we not authorize the reserve? And that's going to be what we're going to basically come up with, and I don't think we can redesign in a month that we need that we have to work with to get back to Mr. Clemens. I may be wrong on that, Mr. Yerman.
Well, on that, thank you. I think you're in part quite correct. Although I think there's some disagreement at TAC as to the as to whether or not the estimates for some of these capital projects are or as precise or as accurate as they need to be. And so for that reason, maybe it would pay to have some of those members in that meeting. But I'm hearing consensus, so I'm thinking that maybe, Doug, you can work on setting up such a meeting and to involve.
Yes, I'll be talking with Dean, and we'll go ahead and work on that.
But in terms of timing, there's some urgency because we need to make the June board meeting.
Exactly. We can go ahead and try and get something set up just as soon as possible. What would your committee feel is how much time are they going to need to review prior to, or whoever is sitting on the on the meeting is going to need to review prior to meeting? I mean, couple weeks?
I would think I would expect our GM or to attend. I think a couple weeks would be fine.
Yeah, Mr. Ewing, you think that's going
to
be enough?
Well, I think it is. I was just trying to. We've had our last March meeting, which was the 17th, and our next meeting would be the first week in April. And I would think we would want one council meeting before we wanted to come back and have a firm answer for the advisory committee. I think that would be necessary. So I don't know whether that's going to be 2 weeks or 3 weeks. 3 weeks? Yeah, it's going
to
be.
Just before I go. Wanted to introduce our new accountant for Flood Control Zone 3, which is Jenny Brunick. And she's taking over for Jennifer Colvard, who went to the General Services Agency. So we did a trade. We traded Jennifer for Jenny. And so she's going to be working on Zone 3, and no doubt we'll ease her into the process. And hopefully pretty soon you won't have to look at me anymore.
That might be an improvement. Yeah.
Well, I can look over there and see that it is an improvement.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't be quite that crude, Ted.
All right. No other questions for Mr. Clemens or Ms. Brunick? Welcome aboard. Thank you. It looks like we're to Old Business C, Interim Downstream Release Schedule, and that I think your name's on that, Doug.
Yes, sir, it is. The Interim Downstream Release Schedule, or the acronym as we refer to it, IDRIS, is a program put together designed to try and save water in Lopez Reservoir during our winter season when we have sufficient rain and runoff into Arroyo Grande Creek that will preclude or take away the need for us to conduct releases into the creek system. Just by way of brief background, in the mid to late 1990s, the district was conducting its normal operations, which was to turn off the downstream releases from the reservoir into the creek. And we did so in November of 1 year, and then in January of the next year, early January of the next year, a couple of dead steelhead trout, which are listed species, were found dead in the creek. Subsequent to that, we had a meeting with council and representatives from the federal and state agencies that oversee such species, and we agreed to release a certain amount of water into the creek system until we completed a habitat conservation plan, which will be next item on the agenda after the IDRIS. So 4 million gallons a day is what we're releasing into the creek right now, and that's over 4,400 acre feet a year. The safe yield on the project is for up to 4,200 acre feet per year to be released into the creek, so we're a couple hundred acre feet over that. So the concept for the IDRIS is to try to save some of those releases when we're having winter weather. Now, this winter obviously is like a few of those preceding, and we haven't had much opportunity to really fully implement the IDRIS. So what we have done, though, is we've reduced our releases over the past 40 to 50 days down to 3.5 million gallons a day, and that has achieved some savings in water. The other thing we did is that at one point in time, we reduced our releases to 3 million gallons a day, and that only lasted for about a day or two when we realized that we were starting to lose surface flow at Rodriguez Bridge, which is the bridge that you cross over to go up to the base of the dam.
Is for Mr. Bird on IDRIS, interim downstream release schedule?
No, sounds reasonably clear.
Do you know, Mr. Bird, were we able to save any water this winter?
I think we saved on the order of 50 to 60 acre feet, but I haven't calculated it lately.
Would you check for the next meeting? My recollection is the contract says we will not release more than 4,200 acre feet downstream.
The contract does say that, and I believe it's paragraph 2 or paragraph 4 that indicates that there is also potential for other releases for legal requirements. But we can bring that back at the next meeting.
Probably should bring that back as an agenda item.
Okay.
Did we get fined for these? Did we get fined for the fish?
No, we did not. As I indicated, we did meet with representatives from the state and federal agencies. That would be Fish and Game, National Marine Fisheries Service, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We had our water rights attorney there. Our department head at that time was in the meeting. I was there. The individuals who came from the federal agencies included Mr. Anthony Spina, who is the biologist who oversees this area, along with their special agents, which is a nice way of saying they're law enforcement personnel. So the agreement was at that time that we would go ahead and conduct these releases until we complete the habitat conservation plan, which I'll be discussing next.
You know, for the committee, you have to recognize that we release water downstream, but we don't have much control over the agricultural people downstream. So someone sticks a pump in the creek and dries up the creek, it's not really our fault. And so fish can be stranded under that circumstance, and yet we're releasing quite a lot of water.
Yeah, we did stop them taking water out of the creek, didn't we? I mean, we had Steve Talley in here, didn't we? That was going to end.
Brian Talley indicated that I think he indicated that there was one location where they did do that. I don't know whether he indicated they had stopped or not. So perhaps that whole subject could be brought to tack again, and then we can bring it up here at the committee.
Okay.
Well, any other questions on interim downstream release schedule? Does the audience have any questions or comments on that item? All right. HCP, Habitat Conservation Plan.
Okay. Your staff report includes a extensive chronology, and ordinarily we don't provide this much, but in deference to the new members to the committee, and it runs over 2007, 2008, and then 2008, 2009. Your next update will be for only the 2008, 2009. Again, the Habitat Conservation Plan, or HCP, is an extensive set of studies, biological, physical, and others, to determine the end result is to develop a contract or an implementing agreement between the county or the that would flow out into the ocean and be used to attract the fish. They can sense or smell the particular creek that they came from. So when they come back in, you put that out, and then they can come back up. What we're trying to do is develop a program that will mimic natural flows and historical flows that occurred prior to us getting into this, and then have a program that is both suitable for the species out there and as well as being ensuring that we are able to maintain the Lopez Project as a viable drinking water supply and supply for our agricultural users along Arroyo Grande Creek, everybody within Zone 3. Right now, we've been having conference calls with Mr. Anthony Spina from National Marine Fisheries Service. We have some very technical work that we've been doing and develop and trying to determine how much flow we're actually going to put into the creek during the wintertime for attraction flows. We had one set of scenarios, and that didn't quite work for everybody, so we've got another set. We're trying to push this up to the point where we're meeting or discussing on conference calls at least twice a month, if not more often. And, in fact, we will have another conference call with our consultants and with National Marine Fisheries next week. And in addition, we'll be asking Mr. Spagnolo to attend as a representative from the from your technical advisory committee. We need to have the TAC involved at this point in time. As we proceed, we'll also get Fish and Game back into the game and involved with these conversations, and also U.S. Fish and Wildlife. Right now, we're hoping to get the business of the downstream releases for attraction flows wrapped up within the next several months. Once that's done, we will incorporate it back into the original habitat conservation plan and then reissue that document as a new final document. And at that point in time, all the concerned agencies will go back in and they will review the document and make their comments. And that should get us going on the process to get the thing, get it wrapped up and get it finalized. As I said, we will be having another conference call with National Marine Fisheries and our consultants and Fish and Game next week. We have been asking our local salmon enhancement group for some information and some data that was developed by their consultant, Swanson Engineers. It's information that National Marine Fisheries asked for, and by doing so, going to Salmon Enhancement, we've saved some consultant money on our end, and Salmon Enhancement, we've been fairly open with them and providing information to them, so we've got a little bit of give and take on that, so we're all coming out ahead on it. And that's pretty much my presentation, Mr. Gehring, unless you have any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bird. And questions for Mr. Bird on HCP?
SPA. They filed a complaint regarding our downstream releases. That complaint was filed with Fish and Game and with State Water Resources Control Board. Long story short, Mr. Ehring, full on with the HCP has been on the order of something like 10 years, and that be starting from when we first started hiring consultants and meeting with the State Board to discuss how to deal with the issues. And I think we're on the expense range. We're in the around the $900,000 at this point in time. That would include consultants, legal counsel, staff, and also a number of physical improvements, including some gauge stations.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ms. D?
My question is concerning the graphs and charts they're using to determine the release, and it's saying here that they're using charts utilizing a percentage, 40% of flows through the Lopez Creek gauge as the amount of water to release for passage flows, and they said this equates to approximately 20% of the total flow into the reservoir.
Right. You're correct on all points, and I must add that in our last discussion, our last conference call, I indicated to both our consultants and to the federal and state agencies that 40% was not anything that staff was going to recommend to your committee. But 40% is a starting point, and it allows us to, what it did was allow us to present a new model to those agencies, resource agencies, as a proposal. And I will state that on each one of those pages that we provided to them, it does say draft subject to review. And I reiterated that a number of times in the conference call. As staff to your committee and to the Lopez Project, I'm not real happy with that amount of water being set aside, but we were able to see what impact that would have on the project overall. Say from, and what we do is we look at it from when the project was constructed and completed in 1969 up to, I think we've been using data up to 2004. So I appreciate your concern. I have the same concern as does everyone else on the staff side who's been dealing with this. Once we get all the detail ironed out on exactly which model we're going to use and which, I didn't discuss this, but we have trigger mechanisms that we look at to determine when it's a proper time to conduct passage flows, then we'll play with the amounts and the percentages. And, you know, that the Lopez Creek gauge is above the dam. It does account for approximately 50% of the flow into the reservoir. So if we throw a 40% figure on there, then that's about 20% of the flow into the reservoir, and that's a lot of water. And when you start looking at baseline flows and then add that in, and then you add in what we need, our needs are for agricultural users, it is significant. And it's not something that we intend on staying with. And I've, as I said, I've indicated that to all the parties in, who are participating in the call. And
this informal agreement that was reached between staff and the resource agencies on the level of downstream release, do you know who's who was present at that, who might have witnessed that agreement?
Yes. The Public Works Director, actually the county engineer at that time, Mr. Tim Nansen, County Council, Mr. John Jenkins, our water rights attorney, Jan Goldsmith, Anthony Spina from National Marine Fisheries, National Marine Fisheries Law Enforcement Agent out of Monterey, a fish and game law enforcement agent from the local area. I believe my supervisor at that time was Tony Boyd. He was there, and I was there, and there may have been a couple other individuals. I believe there was somebody there from U.S. Fish and Wildlife also.
Certainly enough people to perhaps draft an accurate memorandum which would describe what took place.
Yes.
Could we get that, please?
We can.
Thank you. Anybody else? Questions? Anybody from the audience?
Merrill Lee Hyman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to thank Mr. Byrd for his persistence in this HCP, but I really am appalled at the process and the length of time. It is a disgrace. It has been far too long and far too costly. I do believe we should use water for all life. That's people, our agriculture, and our wildlife. But to take this long to come to an agreement on what should be done is unconscionable. I wonder if you could tell me if the $900,000 estimate of cost included the cost of the water released each day, because that does cost us also. What would be that calculation in cost? And I do appreciate that you are continuing this process and hope you can finish it quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Lee. Anyone else from the audience have a comment? Question? Anything on this item? Seeing none, how about on the committee panel? Anybody else? Yeah. Let me take a moment here. Before the time that we began doing large environmental releases, the average amount of surplus water available to the agencies was somewhere around 600 acre feet a year. And that was divided up based upon the desires of the various communities and availability. And if push came to shove, which it didn't very often that I recall, but if it did, then it was divided up based upon entitlements. So if you took a very conservative estimate
of the amount of water we could have gotten had we not been making those releases, perhaps something on the nature of 6,000 acre feet over 10 years, probably a lot more than that.
1,500 might be a little high, but $1,500 an acre foot.
I imagine we're paying $1,500 for Lopez. Mr. Byrd, do you know offhand what the average Lopez cost per acre foot would be?
I don't, but I think that you're fairly close to into the ballpark.
So, all right. Any other comments on that issue before we move on?
Other than we could agree with the public that it's taking far too long and costs too much money.
And they are saying 2010, June 2010 is when they'll have a plan for us. Is that correct? Are we expecting it by then?
We are hoping for it, very seriously, yes. As the lady from the audience indicated and as Mr. Gehring has indicated, this has been a long, lengthy process, and frankly, a lot of it has been in my opinion, has been a lot of foot dragging on the part of the agencies that we're dealing with. When we first submitted the Habitat Conservation Plan, it sat for a couple of years before we were contacted, and we had a heads up about that prior to time of submittal that they had indicated that they had a number of Habitat Conservation Plans in draft form that were sitting on their desk before ours came in. So, not necessarily for the same species, but for other listed species. So, but yes, it's frustrating. It has been a long time. So.
Well, that brings up the reason why I'm more interested in this informal agreement, because the resource agencies have us over a barrel until they approve that HCP, which could be an indeterminate number of decades at the rate things are going. We have to release this amount of water, apparently. And I'm beginning to wonder whether we should be looking more closely at that.
If I may add two comments. At the meeting back in the 1990s, we were told by the law enforcement officers that if we ever did reduce releases below the amount agreed to, that they would be coming back and they would be seeking enforcement action. And, in fact, they had been in the mood for taking enforcement action against the district at the time we met, but they wanted to see what the district was willing or not willing to do. The other thing I should mention is that about 5 or 6 years ago, a couple of more fish were found dead in the creek, and we got an immediate visit from a gentleman named Tom Gaffney, who's a special agent with National Marine Fisheries Service. He's quite aware of how the operations at the project worked, and one of the first things he asked for was copies of our flow chart recordings indicating how much water was released into the creek. We provided those. They indicated that we had been keeping our releases steady. And so his next statement to us after he got those was that, well, it must be something going on with the pumping by the ag users in the downstream areas. That where the dead fish were found were down into the flood control channel. If you know, it's a very sensitive system. If you have
federal government,
good fishing.
Yeah. There ought to be a stimulus package back there, Jim, that would help us.
There is, but we're not getting it. Any other comments from any of the committee members on that item? And I don't see any burning questions rising from the audience. So I suppose we're on to Spillway Raise Project Agency endorsement status. Mr. Byrd.
Yes, sir. Okay. I've had lengthy discussions with Mr. Benedicts about this, and I have a lengthy little presentation here, and if you have any questions in midterm, please feel free to stop me. I think the critical issue with the Spillways Project is for us to determine which of your agencies is going to be willing to participate and endorse the project. Okay, and we actually cannot start until we get an answer from each agency on whether or not they wish to participate. In other words, we can't proceed. Now, in discussing this with the Public Works Director, Pavel Ogren, he's envisioning that what will happen with this is something similar to what they're looking at with State Water Project and the proposed peripheral canal, and that we know that not everybody is going to buy into the peripheral canal, and some folks are. Some agencies will, some agencies won't. What they're proposing to do is to develop an agreement and a memorandum of understanding for the peripheral canal. That would be the same system that we would use here, and we would initiate it once we know who all, which agencies want to participate. The district would act as a neutral party and in an advisory role to your agencies. We would have an agreement and a memorandum of understanding on how to proceed. This could probably take up to a year or two to get through the entire process and complete. The other thing that Mr. Benedict indicated was is that we could probably use some of the capital improvement project reserve dollars to initiate a project. But again, this may be a topic for more discussion at the special meeting that we discussed earlier. Our indications is that the city of Pismo Beach is willing to be the lead on this, and as district staff and the county, we don't have an issue with that. The other thing that we're looking at is County Service Area 12. We need to, as the district, need to take a look at that. We have a few individuals in there that are over their allocations. I've got to work on developing letters to them indicating that, you know, we're reviewing this. They may be required to participate since they can't seem to keep their water use under the amount that they have allocated to them. We'll also be sending out a letter to the other individuals and agencies within CSA 12 asking if they want to participate. The other thing that came up was a project that we want to proceed with, then we can go back to the resource agencies and renegotiate on that side. Okay, I think that pretty much wraps up all the information that I have for you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Bird. Questions, comments?
We were going to get a letter from the county about participation. And so far I've received something from the attorneys telling us the kinds of things that might come up environmentally and so forth. But I thought there was going to be a letter coming out talking about the cost per agency and that kind of thing. And I haven't seen that.
I'm sorry. I'm personally not aware of that, but I'll be glad to look into that for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that may be a venue for getting confirmation from each of the agencies, I suppose. Did you get a letter from Pismo saying that they were willing to participate, for instance?
I believe they had indicated at the TAC meeting, I believe, that they would be willing to participate, but and also to to be the lead agency on the project.
Okay, yeah, thank you. And Mr. Myers could comment on Grover Beach's position, I think.
Well, nobody's told me what the position is yet, so I don't think I can.
Okay, thank you. Well, then we'll... All right, so procedurally, though, Mr. Bird, we each need to go back to our respective agencies and get some sort of an indication, perhaps a resolution or... certainly a voice vote or something from them.
Okay, and I'll be discussing this tomorrow with Mr. Benedict's in regard to Mrs. Dean's question about the letter with the cost per agency.
I could suggest that Mr. Gehring's observation a letter from your agency explaining what the cost and benefits were might be the catalyst that gets some advice back to me to get to you about what Grover Beach wants to do. I can go talk to the general manager, the manager, and find out what he thinks, but that'll be the board will have to decide, I suppose.
I would imagine, yes.
So we need some information, or at least Mr. Peral will need some information. So.
Understood.
Okay.
I can say that our council already approved a resolution to participate, and we had an estimated cost of what it was, but it never came to us in writing as to what the estimated cost would be.
Yeah. I don't have any information.
And then in the TAC meeting, our chief engineer and head of the Public Works Department agreed that we would head this committee up. So.
Again, I've got a little bit of information for you. And as you're all aware, this is coming out of the concerns regarding the operating costs at the treatment plant. I think it also goes along with the current mood in local government and in particular the county, and I'm sure in your local cities and community services districts, with the economy being the way it is, we're taking a hard look at everything and not just the operations out at the Lopez plant. But so with that being said, the information that I've been given is that, what we're going to be doing is reviewing costs for other similar facilities. And as part of that, we're going to be looking at costs for labor, comparable plants, as I said, energy costs and chemical costs. There is some investigation into the use of solar energy as a possible payback. We're not sure exactly how much energy could be generated and what the time period would be for the payback to come around on that, just to pay for the capital costs of purchasing and installing it. There is the 45-day test that was conducted for Lopez and the figures with that, and I believe that Mr. Benedict's indicated that could be utilized as part of this. At this point, with the way we're having to prioritize things in the office, this is taking precedent over the issue of the ag water use. And so this is where we're putting our efforts. In addition to everything else, we are getting recommendations from our staff at the plant, and those recommendations for cost-cutting measures are going to be part of the review process. As far as the participants in, if you will, an ad hoc committee, task force, or technical advisory group, we're looking at having district staff, Mr. Benedict's, gentleman from our treatment plant, Mr. Ron Coleman, Craig Kessler. I know that Mr. Gehring and Mr. Wallace have indicated a willingness to serve. I think that we have some issues getting beyond two elected officials from your committee on there with the Brown Act. If we have a third, it makes a problem. So that's what we're looking at for makeup on the committee. If there's any other suggestions, we're more than willing to look at those. Dean has indicated to me that we're hoping to have the first meeting by the end of this next month. And in order to do that, we need to have the group set up and ready to go by the middle of April. At this point in time, he's anticipating that once we get
funded by grants of some sort, I know that this might be an area that they could use.
As you're all aware, there are a number of programs that are coming around. They're looking at some stimulus money. We're looking at the Integrated Regional Water Management Plan. There's some new things coming around on that. In fact, over the next month or so, there's going to be a number of status meetings, webcasts, and seminars. And so we're trying to review every possible opportunity for anything that's out there, spillway project, whatever, that would meet the criteria. Unfortunately, some of the stimulus money is being targeted for projects that are shovel-ready, if you will. In other words, pre-applications for those, and we determined that we did not have any at this point. There was one possible, but it wasn't part of the Lopez project. Pre-applications were due by the end of last month. Complete applications are due in June, and a complete application would include an entire final set of plans and all the CEQA and environmental work being completed so that that could all be submitted with a full application, provided the project met the criteria and was given a go-ahead. So, and then once it was submitted, there was something like a 60 to 90-day turnaround time, and then you had to be ready to go after that. And so that one particular instance, we didn't see anything that we had within anything that the county looks at. There was one possible in Santa Margarita, but it turns out we have another program that's taking precedence over that through USDA. So, again, though, as these programs come around, we're taking a look at those and seeing, you know, seeing what we've got in all of our projects throughout the county and all the systems that the county operates and seeing if there's something that we can do.
That might be one area to look at when we're prioritizing our capital improvement projects, those that would be available or could be available. And what I'm hearing is that if some of these projects don't come through on time, that the money would be available to others to use. So I would pursue it as much as we could. I'm sure you're looking at that, but aggressively.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, and you know, talking with Mr. Kurt Souza from the State Department of Health Services about opportunities, you know, he sees maybe enough money coming into California to fund a certain number of projects, maybe on the order of 100 or so, depending on the amount of the projects. And they had indications that they were going to get applications for over 500. So, but yes, we are taking a look at all of those and seeing what we can do, see what will apply. So, we have a number of individuals who are almost dedicated to reviewing these and taking a look at and seeing what we've got. So,
great, thank you.
Mr. Myers, anything?
They're starting to come out with the guidelines on what projects would qualify, so it's very preliminary.
Okay, well, probably we ought to remand that to the technical committee then and see what we can come up with, because it seems to me that there are opportunities in the stimulus package, particularly with regard to energy conservation and so forth, that could be looked at that might fund solar power for the plant or might rebuild the hydroelectric plant as an imaginative project, something like that. Mm-hmm. Ah, Mr. Beaton's stepping forward. Perhaps he has something to add.
Just to let you know, I have been in contact with REC Solar, a local company that they're the number one solar installer in the United States. They are. I did take them out to the plant out there. They looked at that. There is a possibility. They can provide solar cells that would run the plant out there, provide the electricity. They are now in contact with our energy coordinator for the county to see what can be done. There are quite a few projects in the county that were interested in solar. To make it work effectively out there, what they do is they go to another company who pays for all the solar cells, so there's no upfront cost for us, and then we buy the electricity from them. We set up a power agreement to say over the next 20 years we'll buy the electricity at this particular cost. And you hope that that cost is going to be less than what, say, PG&E would charge you. So you do the best you can there. The advantage for the other company is that they can qualify for certain rebates and tax incentives and things that, as a public agency, we can't get. And so it makes sense for them. It makes sense for us in that it could be a potential cost savings for us over the years for the energy, or at least to have a very fixed cost that we can plan on. So, you know, with the energy costs in California in the last few years, you know, they've gone up, they've gone down. It's been pretty hard to predict. This new plant is certainly much more, has a quite a bit higher energy requirements than the old plant. So it's one of the things we would certainly look to try to take advantage of if we could. There are places up there where you could put solar cells, it would work fine. They would not obstruct, you know, public's view and such. So it looks like there could be some possibilities there. So, well, we are actively looking into it.
Okay, thank you for that. Any other comments on this?
Just so to make you aware, Mr. Beeden, I did sit in on a telephone conference with an agency from Washington, D.C. that was broadcast nationwide that talked about how to apply for the stimulus funding. And they did direct us, in part at least, to the California Energy Commission. And they've got a site that you can go on and find. And they will likely be receiving quite a large amount of stimulus money that would be available in grant form for competitive projects to finance things that would perhaps be similar to this photovoltaic power system we're talking about. So what I'm wondering is, how in the heck do we fund or do we need to figure out how to fund the staff time to apply for
this package, the fiscal effect on California? And it does talk about funds spent directly by federal agencies, and it looks like the electrical transmission will be through a federal agency. But it gives you some ideas and opportunities. So what I'll do is maybe get your email and then PDF it to you or send it to you if you'd like that. Just give me your email and I'll send it. It's the best thing I've seen to describe everything that's going to be happening as closely as possible as they know at this time.
Okay, thank you. That reminds me, Mr. Burden, in looking at the contact list that I have, it's quite out of date in terms of names and email addresses and so forth for committee members. I'm just wondering if we could get an up-to-date one prepared and sent to everybody.
The one for your committee? Sure.
Okay. That would be good.
Yeah, it's got everybody's email address on it.
Any comments from the audience on that item? I see no one bursting at the seams to come up to the podium. So, with that, committee member comments. Anybody got anything else they want to talk about? Mr. Aaron?
No, I don't have any comments. I think I made all my comments during the meeting. Thank you.
Same for me.
Okay.
Like Ted, I'm kind of commented out myself.
Me too. Yeah. All right. We are adjourned. Next meeting will be at Pismo Beach, May 21st, 2009, unless we get something set up as a special meeting on the budget issue.